our desires become corrupted. They become disordered.
Pastor Christopher Eskett, author of our book of the month, Disordered, Lies About Human Nature and the Truth That Sets Us Free.
Instead of being focused upon doing what God gave them to do for us, we then become curved in on ourselves, and the desires are oriented towards something that is not wholesome or not healthy.
Learn more about Disordered at issuesetc.org. I am old enough to remember a time when there wasn't even in our imagination something like the internet. Now it is everywhere. We depend on it. Not only do we depend on it to do our banking, our travel, all of those things, virtually every activity we do in the world, in our everyday lives, but we also depend on it in a very unhealthy way. We've become dependent on this technology that in many ways has improved our lives, but in other ways have destroyed many lives. What about a generation that's never known life without the internet and instant and constant connectedness? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Joining us to talk about digital natives and online versus real life, Josh Pauling. He's a classical educator, head elder at All Saints Lutheran Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's a columnist for Modern Reformation and Salvo, and he's author of a column for Salvo titled Consider John the Savage. Josh, welcome.
Hey, Todd. Thanks.
What is a digital native?
A digital native is someone who has only known life since the digital revolution. So this would be somebody who's always has had access to a computer. The internet just seems like a normal thing. Digital devices seem normal. And this term is usually used in relation then to digital immigrants, those who grew up before the information age, those who have some experience before the digital revolution, right? Those who have some, you might say, like a reservoir of real life experience before digitalization started to occur.
There's now this generation that you mentioned that does not remember life without the internet. What are they saying about online life versus real life?
Yeah, there's some really fascinating stuff, and I'm sure we can all see it with teenagers we know. I've been a teacher for years and still doing some tutoring. I just had my class today with seniors, and we talk about these things a lot. We can see it with our children, with our nieces and nephews, people in church and community and so forth. Really, what we're seeing and what teens are telling us is that they really are coming to see themselves as that they're being their true selves online, we might say. They're finding their friends online. Some even say that their online communities are becoming their true family, that they've found their family rather than been given a family. And there's a lot of good sources on this. There was a great book just published last year called Gen Z Explained. This was by a group of college professors and really dug into the digital world and how teens and college students are living in that world. And that some of the terms they used were things like fine-grained identity, that teens and college students are fine-tuning their identity online. They're crafting and curating just exactly what they want to be online. And then really the impetus for this recent piece was a New York Times focus group they did with teens, where they just asked them questions and gathered information from teens themselves as to what they're saying. And some of the quotes just really reveal the length to which people are living online. I'll just read a couple quotes real quick. Trinity, a 12-year-old, said simply, "I'm more myself when I'm online." Nate, a 14-year-old, said, "Online feels more peaceful and calming. You don't have to talk to anybody in person or do anything in person. You're just sitting on your chair or on your bed, watching or doing something." And then Andrew, an 11-year-old, said, "When I'm online, I can mute myself and they can't really see me. I can't mute myself in real life." And that's just a sampling of the data that's been gathered in a variety of sources.
Why is this generation fleeing real life?
I think there'd definitely be a lot of factors. Some that come to mind, just the unknowns and risks of real life. There's a lot of friction in real life. There's confrontation, there's corrugations, there's resistance. And that's uncomfortable because we don't have control of those things. Whereas online, it's much less friction. It's much smoother. We have much more control. And we all experience this, right? I mean, it's easy to prefer something online or to prefer a text message than to actually having to have a conversation on the phone or in person with the awkward silences. Just the other night at dinner, I was thinking about this. Before dinner, I was spending a little time revising something I was writing. And in that environment, you know, I have quite a bit of control. I'm typing the letters on my computer. I'm thinking, I'm writing. And then we sat down to dinner, right? And I opened up the Bible to do devotion. And I think I bumped my wall with the Bible. And, you know, all of a sudden there was water on the table. And then my daughters start talking and there's this and that. I don't have any control. And the internet gives a false sense of control. So I think those are some of the reasons why so many people prefer online life.
You reference Freddy DeBoer, the author of the book, The Cult of Smart. What has he had to say about how young people prefer living online?
Yeah, he's had some really good insights into this. He's an interesting thinker. What he was saying is basically how kids the quiet part out loud. In other words, they're not even trying to cover up why they like online life. They're just saying how it is. They're saying it straight that I like online life because I'm in control, right? Because I can mute myself, as that one kid said that I quoted earlier. And he also points out, though, that it's not their fault, that it's a lot of it, the environments and patterns that adults and those in authority and parents have put them in that establish these routines for them, whether it's the home and how prominent screens might be in a home, and also in the school and how prominent air. So it's not just the kids' fault. It's also those who are around them that are setting up the environments and structures in such a way that allow screens to become so alluring.
How is this more than just a kids these days problem?
Yeah, I remember I tried to address this a lot in my classroom because as a teacher, I had a phone policy where I would collect student phones every day and we'd put them in these pouches on the back of my classroom door. And on the first day of class, I would explain to them why we'd do this. And I would say, this is not a kids these days problem. This is a human problem. And because I care about you as human beings, we're going to do this together, right? I'd put my phone in there. They'd put their phones in there. We wanted to be fully present with each other in the classroom. So this is something all humans are susceptible to because it's really an addiction, right? The way screens interact with the brain, the dopamine hits, all the rest, all the data is there. And companies know this. This is another major factor that shows it's not just a kids these days problem, that the social media is intentionally addictive. The best engineers and designers in Silicon Valley are really racing to the bottom of our brainstems. And so this is something that can affect us all, but certainly maybe even more so with brains are still developing. And also as digital natives, they don't know anything else, right? They don't have that reservoir of prior experience without devices.
What are some connections to Aldous Huxley's dystopian novel, Brave New World, in particular, the drug of that novel, Soma, that you have found?
Sure. Yeah, this book seems to get more and more relevant with each passing cultural event, for sure. In the book, Soma is the drug that is used in the society in Brave New World to really give people a jolt of happiness, to numb them to other things. It becomes a form of escape, and it's easily available. The government gives it to them in powder form, in pill form, in aerosol form. And it really seems that the government in Brave New World is more than happy just sort of keeping the people happy. And they do that by just giving them doses of this. And it really keeps the people subservient. It keeps them soft. And in many ways, the internet and social media seem to be our soma. It's always available, freely distributed, and you can get it in any form you want.
In that novel, who was John the Savage and what lesson can we learn from him?
So John the Savage is one of the main characters. And in the midst of this really soma numbed world, John is the only remaining person who's born naturally from a mother. And so he has some experience outside of this world state, outside of this soma numbed existence. And so John sort of sees the things that are going on and has a different perspective. Now, he's not necessarily the hero of the book, and he has his own fair share of demons to reckon with, his own problems and so forth. But he wants something more than what Soma can offer and what the world state can offer. He's looking for risk. He's looking for exhilaration. He's looking for things that most people have never even experienced in the book. And there's a wonderful exchange in the book where he's interacting with the world controller, Mustafa Mond, great name for a world controller. And basically, he just concludes that I like inconveniences. He doesn't want comfort. He wants God. He wants danger. He wants freedom. He wants goodness. And Mustafa Mond responds and basically says, well, all right, well, you're claiming your right to be unhappy. And John sort of thinks about it for a minute, and then he says, yeah, I am. And so John really is getting at something important about reality, that reality has risk. Reality might bring unhappiness, but there's something inherent in that experience of reality that we as humans need, even if it brings suffering, even if it brings risk, even if it brings unhappiness.
Josh Pauling is our guest. We're talking about digital natives and online versus real life. On the other side, a observation by Rod Dreher in his book, Live Not by Lies, right along these lines.
Speaking the truth to power, the Lutheran option, cancel culture, media bias, a dying man's consolation. Some of your favorite guests will address these topics at the 2023 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, June 16th and 17th in River Forest, Illinois.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service.
Our church loves and is grateful for those that serve our country. Operation Barnabas, part of Ministry to the Armed Forces, equips you to reach out to veterans in your community to bring Christ to those that served. Call Ministry to the Armed Forces at 314-996-1337 or email lcmschaps@lcms.org.
Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
God bless our military.
Lutheranism in the Public Square. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, is looking for an English teacher with a master's degree for the 2023-24 school year. Edwardsville is 30 minutes from downtown St. Louis. The position would involve teaching upper-level, dual-credit English classes. For more information, send an email to Principal Jay Krause, J-A-Y-K-R-A-U-S-E, at MELHS.org, jkrause@MELHS.org.
What does the death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ have to say about our political debates surrounding transgenderism? Well, in the April issue of the Lutheran Witness, the Reverend Andrew Packer takes up this very discussion, how our Lord's death and resurrection, in fact, has everything to say about the debates surrounding transgenderism. We also talk about the family and the church and how the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ informs our life in all three of these estates. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We have added an event for Lutheran singles to the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. This on-campus gathering will feature games and adult beverages. Making the Case is Friday, June 16th and Saturday, June 17th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or by giving us a call, 618-223-8385. Educating a new generation of Lutherans, the 2023 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 16th and 17th in River Forest, Illinois. We're talking about digital natives and online life versus real life with Josh Pauling. He's author of a column for Salvo titled Considering John Savage. Josh, you also note that Rod Dreher makes some interesting observations about Aldous Huxley's dystopian novel Brave New World and the stuff found in there in his book Live Not by Lies.
Yes. So this idea is not new to me. There's been a long tradition of using Huxley's dystopia and also Orwell's as well to analyze things we're seeing today. Neil Postman does this. Dreher does. Many people do. And what's interesting in those two books is you sort of have two different visions of the dystopia of the future. In Orwell, it's really a totalitarian warning. In Huxley, it's really a warning of comfort and ease. Both Postman and Dreher see aspects of both going on in society, but they might lean more in a Huxleyan direction. In other words, that the real danger is that things just become so easy and so comfortable, and that that's really a dangerous tool. And so Dreher talks about this in his book and also in other articles, that we might need to fight for our right to be unhappy, he says. But the problem with that is that's not a very marketable campaign, right? To fight for your right to be unhappy. But there's something there that John the Savage was onto.
You say if we're going to disengage from virtual life and re-enter real life, we can't do it alone. Why is real life community necessary?
Yeah, that's exactly right. We can't do it alone. And I think that's where John the Savage ultimately falls apart. Because in an interesting twist in the ending of the book, he's not actually the hero. He actually kills himself after a moral failing that he can't find forgiveness for. He didn't have anyone else alongside him that was a fellow seeker, if you will, that was also willing to commit to this right to be unhappy, if you will. So yeah, we can't just be individuals fighting this alone. We need each other. We need that community, because it's in relationship where we are truly human, relationships to one another, flesh and blood relationships to family, friends, local communities, where we're in those networks of giving and receiving from others. And that also orients us properly towards other human beings, and then orients us properly towards God. And there's no way around the challenges of life. Real life relationships will bring failure. People will let us down. But those relationships also are filled with meaning and possibility far beyond the soma-numbed existence that we find in virtual life or digital life.
What role does real life suffering play in that?
Suffering really brings us outside ourselves, and we come alongside each other in suffering. Into a larger understanding of love, friendship, and human limits. And ultimately, we as Christians, we know that through suffering, God redeems the world. And so we can embrace suffering as part of life, as embodied creatures, as human beings with limits that are inbuilt in our design. I think also there's a wonderful little story I just want to share about suffering and what it brings. There was a book about 5 years ago by a young man about my age who had been diagnosed with terminal cancer. And he was a very bright individual. He was a doctor, and he had a wonderful wife, and this was a shock to them. They talked long and hard about what are they going to do in their final few years. It was an aggressive form of cancer. His diagnosis was quite short. And one of the questions they asked is, did they want to have children before he died? And the wife asked him, well, wouldn't that bring more suffering into the world? Wouldn't that be hard? Wouldn't that make dying more difficult? Wouldn't that be hard for our children? And then the father, who was dying of cancer, said, wouldn't it be great if it did? Wouldn't it be great if it did? In other words, that suffering, although it would be difficult, was part of being fully alive and bringing new humans into the world, would far outweigh the suffering of experiencing the death of a loved one. I thought that was just such a beautiful way to put that. Wouldn't it be great if it did? So yeah, suffering plays a role. It's part of life. And we need to have that Christian view of it that allows us to get through it. And ultimately, God redeems it.
How does the Christian congregation, the church, how does it offer something better than online life?
Well, first off, we are embodied creatures. We have bodies for a reason. And online, you can never recreate that. So in the community of the church, we are embodied together. We come together physically in the divine service. We know each other. We shake each other's hands. So that embodied nature of the church is central. And then, of course, also, we meet Christ in the divine service, in the community of the church, through word and sacrament. So here we are connected to tangible, physical things that ground us in what it means to be embodied beings, and ultimately connect us to Christ, our ultimate destiny, and then also give us the promise of a perfect glorified body in the resurrection and in the life of the world to come. So even when life is difficult, even when we have that suffering, even when the allure of online life, you know, is pulling at us because it seems easier, we have that promise of ultimate deliverance in the promise of the resurrection and Easter season. What a great promise to celebrate.
Joshua Pauling is a classical educator. He's head elder at All Saints Lutheran Church in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's a columnist for Modern Reformation and Salvo. He's authored a column for Salvo titled Considering John the Savage. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Josh, thanks.
It's a pleasure, Todd. Blessed Easter tide.
Thursday on Issues Etc. We'll discuss ectopic pregnancy, DNC, miscarriage, and abortion with Dr. Donna Harrison, and we'll talk with Dr. Carl Beckwith about the Trinity in the Bible. It's also media coverage of religion with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
You can meet and hear Lieutenant Colonel Alan West at the Share in the Miracle Dinner Thursday evening, May 4th, at the Regency Conference Center in O'Fallon, Illinois. Lieutenant Colonel West is a combat veteran and former U.S. Congressman. Proceeds from Share in the Miracle Dinner benefit Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis. For more information, visit the Facebook page for Unity Lutheran School, East St. Louis. Share in the Miracle Dinner, Thursday evening, May 4th, at the Regency Conference Center in O'Fallon, Illinois.